shoving her there across from him. She'd take off her boots and rub her feet, and she would sit there, quietly talking, radiating intelligence. She told him about her day, and he told her about his. They drank a good Malbec and were enveloped by long, happy silences. Once in a while, they talked about their respective children, Lincoln and Abby, one serious and consistent and exceptional to his mother because he was hers, the other one stormy and highly successful. Still, he thought of Abby as his little girl, and he remembered the exact feeling of her undiluted electoral love for him, a girl on a father's lap, all crinoline and hot bottom. Sometimes, as he and Faith sat together, he said a few words about some woman or other who he'd slept with recently, and how she'd provided a physical outlet which was worth a lot these days, as he entered the terrifying arena of old age and Viagra was as important as sunscreen. Faith listened well, not judging, and she sometimes told him a few shreds of detail from her own life, but mostly she was private. They talked about the people they'd known in common in the old days. He unloaded all his rage and frustration. And they always laughed a lot. Faith had the greatest laugh and the greatest throat. She was the whole package, he thought. But now, sitting in her living room, having lost her respect and incited her anger and contempt because of the stupid botched Ecuador mentor project, that was a torment. I find it hard to believe that you allowed us to step deep into lies just because you didn't pay attention during a meeting, she said. You know it's more than that. Attention is a smokescreen. You have the ability to be attentive. I've seen it. You're attentive toward me. I should have listened better in that meeting, and I shouldn't have let them switch out that woman you liked, and I should have shut down the fund and announced the whole thing publicly. Punish me, Faith. Just don't ice me out. Faith tightened her mouth, and for the briefest moment, she looked like every woman in the world who was angry at a man. I'm going to tell you what I've decided to do, Faith said. And I don't want you to say anything. I just want you to listen. He nodded, folding his hands in his lap in an exaggeration of listening. This was super listening, the kind done by higher beings, and he tried to imitate it now. I'm not going to make a stink, Faith said. That would imperil the foundation and stop us from doing anything ever again. And while I detest the moral vacuum that apparently exists upstairs at Schrader Capital, I can't just quietly quit my job, because where else would I go? I'll continue to take your money, Emmett, but I won't approve of it. I'll take it, and I'll use it, and I'll watch it closely, because I don't really have much choice. We were all put on this earth to row the boats we were meant to row, she said. I work for women. That's what I do. And I am going to keep doing it. I have no idea if this Ecuador story will ever leak out of the building. If it does, it will be an embarrassment, and perhaps it will shut us down. But the bottom line is that I'm not going anywhere. Good. His relief almost sprang from his forehead. I don't know what I would have done if you'd said you were quitting. Oh, you'd be fine. You're the 1% of the 1%. I was very bored until you came here, Faith, Emmett said. Someone once called me a privileged narcissist in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I guess it's true sometimes. He thought, but didn't say, that people like him needed someone to remind them not to be privileged narcissists. They needed someone like Faith to do that. Emmett impulsively took Faith's hand, and for a few seconds she didn't pull away. Then she shifted, and their hands unlinked. All right, then, she said. It's getting late. She stood up, so he stood up, too.
No one else knows about this but Greer Kadetsky? He asked. And whoever told her this?
I'm not certain. They sat silently for a moment.
Well, Greer won't say anything, right?
He asked. Faith shook her head. I very much doubt it, but she's already quit. It was an unpleasant moment. She's someone I like, and someone I brought along.
Yes, in that way you do, showing an interest in them.
Showing an interest is only one part, she said. You also take them under your wing, if that's what they seem to want. But then there's another part, which is that eventually you let them go. Fling. You fling them away, because otherwise they think that they can't manage on their own. Sometimes you fling them too hard. You have to be careful. She stopped. Anyway, you should try showing an interest too, in the ones upstairs. I will, he said, full of feeling. He suddenly thought of two kids, a boy and a girl, both just out of college, who had been hired at the same time at Schrader Capital. They were snappingly smart and eager, with different, distinctive talents, but both were promising. It really takes very little, said Faith, and they are very, very grateful. They try to show their gratitude. There's the proof, she added, nodding toward something in her sight line. Emmett turned to look. On the floor, at the foot of the sofa, was a large, open box that contained various items, some still half-wrapped in festive paper, others unwrapped and opened.
"What's all this?" he asked.
"Thank-you gifts and sentimental objects and private jokes. Personal connections."
"From who?"
"Oh, from everyone. People I've known over the years, even people I've met only once. Sometimes they arrive in the mail, and sometimes they're handed to me at summits and speeches. Always it's someone who says I've helped them in some capacity, and if it comes in the mail, there's a note attached, and sometimes I have no idea who the person is. The name on the note doesn't even sound familiar, or it vaguely rings a bell, though the note makes it seem as if we had some kind of important encounter. And I guess we did, because it was significant to them. These things have been sitting here for far too long, gathering dust. This is only one box of several, the tip of the iceberg. Dina is going to help me go through them this week. Objects have a different meaning to me now at 71. I can't collect more things. It has to be a time of winnowing. Emmett bent and slid the box closer and peered inside, fishing around, looking. Here on top was one of those lacy little pillows that women liked, a sachet. He held it to his nose, but it gave off no scent anymore. Here was a keychain with a little boot on it, probably meant to symbolize the sexy suede boots that Faith famously wore. Here were three different jars, one empty, one with some ancient black jam in it, and perhaps some botulism spores, and one containing jelly beans. The one with jelly beans had a note attached that read, "Faith, I know you must get a lot of jars, am I right, because of your famous jar line? I'm sure you can open this one. In fact, I'm sure you can do anything. XXX, Wendy Sadler." And here was a t-shirt with a picture of a lobster. And here was a copy of an old, stupid-looking children's book called The Bradford Twins' Summer Surprise. On the cover, a poorly drawn boy and girl flew a kite. He opened it and saw that it was inscribed. "Dear Faith, this book was my favorite when I was a little girl, and I wanted you to have it. Love, Denise Mancuso. From that dinner in Chicago."
"So, how was that dinner in Chicago?" he asked.
"What are you talking about?"
"The inscription. Who is Denise Mancuso?"
"I have no idea." Emmett kept pawing through the box. Here was a bracelet made of hemp and bead. Here was a toy plastic spaceship with the name NASA on the side, and a note with it. "Dear Faith, I work here at NASA now as a deputy director for engineering, and if you ever come down to D.C., I'd love to show you around. I wouldn't be here if not for you. Fondly, Olive Mitchell." Here was a box of homemade fudge. Emmett opened it and saw that it now had a teeth-cracking, long-ago-baked igneous surface of sugar and nut, entirely calcified.
What year is this from, Faith? How would I know? Then what decade?
Here was a peacock feather tied with a ribbon, and here a beautiful pen engraved with the strange words, "The pen is mightier than the penis." And here, equally strangely, was a frying pan, never used, a label still on it. What did it represent? Another private joke, he assumed, which Faith might or might not remember, even though the gift-giver had had the impulse to go out and purchase it and give it, for it was a sign of love. All of these women had needed a connection with Faith. She was plasma to them. Maybe it was a mommy thing, he thought. But maybe it was also, I want to be you. There were so many of these women, just so many. But there was only one Faith.
It must be a burden to you to be the most important person to people who aren't all that important to you, he said.
I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation. I get a lot from them, too, remember.
What do you get? He asked. I'm curious.
Well, they keep me in the world, she said. And that was all she wanted to say. He wondered who Faith Frank opened up to. She had her friends, those old women from the old days, including Bonnie, the lesbian with the frizzy hair, and Evelyn, the society lady, in her suits, the colors of Pez. They were intimates of Faith's, he knew. They'd all been photographed together, back in a completely different time. Emmett had a sudden memory of a picture of Faith and the others sprawled around an office. The place looked hectic, messy, busy. But the thing he recalled most was how happy Faith looked among those women, how relaxed and content. Suddenly Emmett wondered why Faith hadn't found a man to be with her all these years, after having been widowed so young. Why did a strong woman need to be her own shield? Or maybe that was just the way Faith wanted it, because men were a distraction or too high maintenance. Or maybe having a man in her life was just one thing too many. He and Faith might have loved each other, he thought now, when it was much, much too late.
I've done everything wrong, he said, not able to keep this to himself.
What? Faith looked alarmed at the outburst.
I could have loved you, he said. I could have done that, Faith. We could have complimented each other. We both live these oversized, sort of ridiculous lives. The sex would have been a release and a revelation, and all the conversations afterward. I would have made you scrambled eggs in the middle of the night. I make good middle-of-the-night scrambled eggs. I bet you didn't know that. But I screwed everything up. And now you think I'm awful.
She stood facing him, still clearly shocked but recovering, one hand lightly massaging her neck for a moment. All she said, finally, was, I don't think that. It was getting late, and he would need to go home soon. His car and driver were waiting, and later he and Faith would lie in their separate beds, in which there was plenty of room for another person if they so chose, which, tonight, they wouldn't. They were older, and they had to carefully mete out intimacy. Emmett slid the box back to where it had been, this box that had held the gifts that Faith had been given by the people in her life she'd known or met and had affected as she went through, the people she could sometimes barely keep track of. But it didn't matter if she couldn't keep track, because she felt tenderly toward them all, and they knew it. Emmett tried to picture what kind of gift he might give Faith to show her how he felt. He couldn't imagine what he could possibly give her, what would have meaning and resonance. But then he realized he did know, for he'd already done it. He'd given her a foundation.
Chapter 13.
Cory Pinto came up with the idea for his video game not in one burst, but over a number of years. He didn't even know he'd been imagining a video game all that time. He just thought of himself as someone who played a lot of actual video games while intermittently thinking heavily and obsessively about losing his brother. But a combination of playing and obsessing eventually made him see what had been inside him. So the story for the game, when it revealed itself, arrived nearly fully formed. For a long time, he'd been periodically preoccupied by the idea that when someone you loved died, you could spend the rest of your life searching the world for that person, and yet you would never, ever find him or her, no matter how many obscure places you went to, no matter how many caves you slipped into, or curtains you parted, or houses you entered. The dead person truly no longer existed. And while as a matter of science, this fact seemed so simple, it was unaccountably hard to accept it when the person was someone you loved. But the thing was, after someone you loved died, the people you still could see, aka the living, might occasionally almost seem to be the person you longed for. There would be a startle of similarity, a flash of familiar head shape or squirt of laughter, and you would whip around so hard only to find a person who is not, in fact, the right person at all. And then you had to wonder, why did this kid in front of you, this stranger whose laugh was so unsubtle, whose expression was coarse, get to be alive while your little brother didn't? And yet, maybe if you really did search hard enough and far enough, you could eventually find the person you were looking for. Maybe Albie was still somewhere in the world over 3 years after his death. Maybe the secret truth about death is that dead people are whisked away from their current lives and forced to live somewhere else far away, a process similar to reincarnation but taking place not in the future but now, a sort of mortality-based witness protection program. And if you found them, they would look the same as they always had. If only you knew where to find them. If only you knew where to look. This was the premise of Corey's game. He himself felt childlike in his inability to accept Albie's death. Of course, in all the important ways, he did accept it, because he wasn't mentally fragile like his mother, and he was able to socialize and have a drink and a conversation about subjects other than death, and he was able to actually interact well with customers and other employees at Valley Tech in crunchy Northampton, 25 minutes from Macapie. The store was a seemingly mellow but demanding place. Customers' attachment to their computers was primal and urgent. They rushed in carrying their laptops like people at the vet, cradling injured or sick animals. "How can I help you?" Corey would gently ask. "It just crashed! Right in the middle of an unbelievably important project."
"Have you backed everything up?"
"Well, no, not recently." Then defensively, "I couldn't have known it would crash."
"Let's have a look."
Corey would go into the workshop in the back with this pliant and willing machine that had no say in the matter. What ailed it in the end was that it was a machine. You could bring it to life a few times, or even many times. But eventually you knew that the customer would have to abandon and replace it, and you would be the one to help facilitate that. It was through the store that Corey became familiar with the online gaming community, which, of course, wasn't really one community, but an astoundingly large and amorphous aggregate of people in separate homes and different time zones around the world who enjoyed playing video games day and night. Sometimes a few people from work played Dota 2 as a team from their separate homes, and after work once a week, the employees at the store gathered at the nearby apartment of burly Logan Berryman, 30 years old, who in addition to being the head tech person at Valley Tech and a programmer, was part of the not insignificant Contra dance community that had sprung up around the Pioneer Valley. Logan and his girlfriend, Jen, lived on the upper floor of a house on Fruit Street with their fiddles, their cat, and canisters of bee pollen that stood in gleaming granularity on the kitchen counter. Relaxing there in the evening, the Valley Tech crew, Logan, Hallie Beatty, Peter Wong, and now Corey, drank beer, and with bared teeth popped edamame beans from their hairy little pods, and then they all played Counter-Strike for a couple of happy hours. Logan and Jen's actual physical world, the progressive world of Northampton, Massachusetts, home of Smith College, consisted of college professors and psychiatrists and various lesbian couples, as well as coffee shops and mixed-breed dogs wearing bandanas and kids who looked like runaways, though half of them were the children of professors and psychiatrists, lost teenagers who slunk back into their book-filled homes at night in time for bed. It was a world that was sexually enlightened and supposedly egalitarian. In Logan and Jen's apartment as the sun set, the women and men played lustily and freely. It was like an equal opportunity dream, whereas Corey knew the online world of gaming was studded with full-throated hate. Women were harassed and threatened constantly in that world, a miniaturized version of the real world. Corey had seen the illiterate screeds that trolls had written on message boards, like, "I'd like to chop off your head and your twat." As Greer had once said to Corey long ago after she'd met Faith Frank and turned her attention to feminism, "I tell myself that the language of chopping off body parts is code for I don't know what to do about this rage I feel." He imagined being here in this apartment with Greer beside him. There would be the stirring sensation of just knowing that these other people thought of them as a couple. He had the sudden, related thought that if Greer were part of a couple down in New York, dating or hooking up at length or however else she described it to herself, maybe the guy had wooed her with stories of combating misogyny. That would be a good way to get through to Greer. The idea flickered inside Corey briefly, then went away. He had no way to get through to her now, nor she to him. The more you were not with a person, the more your lives diverged. Corey could barely understand how people who hadn't known each other early on in life could ever form a couple. The older you got, the more you developed specific peculiarities. A woman would have to be willing to absorb his circumstances. He was a grown man, after all, who lived with his mother. Whenever anyone asked Corey about his living arrangements, he didn't say, "I live with my mom," a sentence that might have a Norman Batesy quality to it. He said instead, "I live at home." In the year 2014, as the economy had mostly recovered, living at home didn't necessarily mean one thing or another. He couldn't stay out too late tonight, because he had to go home and cook dinner for his mother and settle her in before bed, not that he was going to announce why he had to leave. Maybe they would think he had somewhere to go, a woman to meet. He was a handsome man, he knew that about himself. But in fact, the last woman he'd been involved with had been much earlier. Of all people, it had been Kristen Vells. Kristen had been just someone he was aware of on Woburn Road for so long that he had ceased thinking of her as a real person. She was simply someone to whom he and Greer had always felt superior. She had hazily occupied the role of dumb girl who lives on our street. But then when Greer fell out of Corey's life, and Kristen was living at home and working at Pyland, Corey would go to the pizza place sometimes in the late afternoon as the day sank into a violet-gray funk. When he walked in, he would sit and have a slice, and if Kristen was there, they would engage in a monosyllabic conversation that might or might not finally flower into the polysyllabic. This went on for a while. One day he was there at closing time, and he and Kristen left together, walking back up the street with bodies close, which was interesting in its newness. Kristen Vells had a well-formed body, and the fragrance of dough rose up from it like a sweet breeze from an open window. "You want to come over?" he boldly asked this woman who had once been three reading groups below him. The beauty of adulthood was that reading groups did not matter, or at least they did not insure against anything. You could be in the top reading group of everyone in the world, the alpha puma among pumas, and still it would not protect you from your brother dying, or your father leaving, or the person you loved no longer being in your life. Kristen went with Corey into his house for the first time ever, though they had lived on that same block for such a long time. He remembered the day that Greer had first come here, nearly 2 decades earlier. Walking into someone's house was like entering their body. You saw what they were made of and what they had been stewing in all this time. His mother was sitting in front of the TV when he appeared with Kristen. "Ma, you need anything?" he asked her, and she looked up from the recliner that she so often sat in during the day. "I'm fine, Corey," she said, but she squinted uneasily at Kristen. "Who is this girl?" "Kristen from down the block," Kristen offered. "The Velses? With the garden gnomes?" "That's us. But actually, they're gone. Someone stole them a while back." Corey took Kristen upstairs to his room and shut the door. Being there with her, he was forced to compare her with Greer. Here was a replacement woman, a far less interesting model, but a woman, too, fragrant and female, someone who knew what life was like here in Maccabee and wouldn't question why Corey chose to live this way. Plus, she had a plush mouth, the lower lip bisected into 2 little cushions. They smoked a joint, which was the only way to manage this moment. Weed had become more of a condiment in his life, not long after his brief adventures in heroin with Cousin Sab. Smoking a joint took the edge off, whereas snorting heroin had taken the side off, as if in a tornado, and was to be avoided forever. So Corey and Kristen smoked silently together, and then he looked up and saw her suddenly perched above him like a construction crane. He lifted himself slowly toward her, their faces colliding. When her mouth opened, she smelled smoky and rusty, as if there was a taint of blood in there somewhere. While kissing Kristen Vels, Corey realized that sexual arousal came in different strengths, different concentrations. But beyond that, the body didn't judge who it was kissing. It had been so long since he had kissed anyone at all. "You were such a fucking little sissy when you were a kid," Kristen said after the kiss ended and they pulled apart and observed each other. "With your neat little clothes. Did your mom iron your shirts all that time? You always look so neat, so clean, like mama's boy."
"Yep. And now I iron her clothes. Quid pro quo."
"What?"
"Nothing."
He couldn't think of anything more for them to talk about then, so instead of talking, he eased himself on top of her, using all the strength and interest he could gather. They remained entangled for a full month, a month in which they smoked weed and lay in bed for a dazzling number of hours. One day, as they lay there, the room was suddenly flooded with light, and there was a bang, and Corey looked up to see his short mother standing in the doorway.
"I'm constipated," Benedita announced.
"Oh, give me a fucking break," said Kristen quietly.
"Corey, can you get me the Dulcolax? I look around and I can't find it."
"Yeah, Ma, hold on a sec," he said.
His mother retreated, shuffling away. She had become a shuffler over the years. By now he was so used to the sound of her purple slippers on the floors of the house that it was almost soothing to him, as if it were a fire snapping in a hearth. But Kristen looked at Corey with proprietary anger, and he absorbed it and was angry right back at her, for she had no dominion over him, and why would she think she did?
"How gross that your mom tells you her personal things like that," she said.
"Yeah, well, she's got no one else to tell it to."
"I live with my mom, too, but she tells me jack shit, which is the way I like it."
Corey shrugged, wanted her gone. Caring for his mother had become part of his job, his way of being. He managed her life, made it no more painful than it had to be. He didn't want Kristen intruding on that part. She was meant to ignore it, not comment on it. But here she was complaining, pointing it out, offering her opinions. And now everything that had been briefly erotic about Kristen Vels, the tiny tattoo of a doghouse on her ankle and her long, well-cared-for hair and willing mouth, became a source of revulsion. Corey was now uninterested in everything that had to do with this person, because she had overstepped her bounds and also insulted his mother. Or, more than that, insulted his mother and him, what they were to each other. No, she had just insulted him.
"Kristen, I gotta get up," he said.
When he was around her, he found himself speaking like someone he wasn't. Gotta, have to.
"So what, Corey, you're pissed at me because I was grossed out about your mom and her constipation?"
"Something like that."
"Fuck you, Pinto."
"Yeah, well, okay. That's so sweet of you to say."
He stood and found his pants, then his shirt, and had never been so relieved to get dressed. But Kristen wasn't moving. She lay in his bed and just took her time. She smoked a cigarette. She flipped around the dial to see what was on TV and actually settled on a rerun of Boy Meets World, from which he had gotten his name. He had watched this episode, in which Corey quits his school's production of Hamlet after finding out he has to wear tights multiple times when he was young, absorbing how all-American it was, feeling so excited by that aspect. He wished he could trade in the name Corey for Duarte now. He was ready to have that be him, except for the fact that it was his father's name, too, and that brought out another set of feelings entirely. Kristen took the remote control and raised the volume. She was planning to watch the whole show, he knew. "You take your time, Kristen," he thought, and he went off to find the Dulcolax. It was exactly where he had visualized it, on a bathroom shelf half hidden by an ancient, cloudy bottle of something called Jean Nate After Bath Splash. He grabbed the Dulcolax and brought it to his mother. After Kristen left that day, she and Corey became unspoken enemies. Seeing her on the street as she walked to Pyland, he would give a grudging wave, but she would simply make a guttural sound, like, "Are you kidding me?" and keep walking. Soon he stopped waving. Now he was not only Greerless, he was also Kristenless. Eventually, as time kept dissolving, in addition to taking care of his mother and cleaning two of the houses she used to clean, he began to teach himself everything he could about computer repair and game design. Corey was a fast learner, and Valley Tech in Northampton had hired him and trained him, and he soon became adept, a natural, learning the weaknesses of the different machines. He was content there with his fellow employees in the safe, minimalist box of the store. At night he went home and cleaned his house and cooked dinner and then played video games, sitting cross-legged on Albie's bed with Slowey nearby. A few months in, Corey began socializing with the gamers at the store. Logan in particular kept an eye out for him and seemed to feel protective of him. He often encouraged him to come up with an idea for a game which Logan could design. Corey had been trying. At the end of the evening at Logan and Jen's place, Logan walked him out and said to him on the front porch, "You got something yet?"
"Sort of."
"Okay, I'll take that as a positive response. I'm working on a game myself," Logan said. "I really enjoy constructing systems and game mechanics, but you wouldn't have to worry about that. I'd think it through. Thing is, I found a potential angel investor through some friends. He lives in Newton, and he's driving over Wednesday night to discuss it."
"What does he do?"
"Rich oral surgeon. He's a gamer, but he says he has no imagination at all, and he wants to get in on this. He likes the idea of indie games as art pieces. He thinks that if he makes his money back, it's a success. I'm meeting him at Hops, the craft beer place on Masonic. You can come pitch him too if you want."
"Oh, well, I'm not ready for that," said Corey.
"You have until Wednesday. I have a feeling you can get it together by then."
So Corey came home from work and sat down at the table in the living room, with his mother sitting peacefully across from him. In one of Albie's many notebooks, he began to write down some readable notes for the game he'd recently been formulating, but which, really, he'd been formulating for much longer. Then, on Wednesday night, he entered the lacquered wooden hive of Hops in downtown Northampton. It always made him nervous to go to these trendy establishments, because they reminded him of what he'd once had, even for a little while, the wealth that had enclosed him at Princeton, and then again in Manila, before he had given it all up. William Cronish, DDS, was a 35-year-old, tilted-chinned oral and maxillofacial surgeon who wanted very much to look like a nobleman. I was kind of a goth when I was a kid, and I was also obsessed with playing offbeat games. But my dad and my granddad were dentists, and when it came time to figure out my life, I allowed myself to get pushed in that direction, because nothing I was interested in could earn me a living. So now I have a great practice, but I still think about that other side of myself. I'd love to be in on the ground floor of some cool game. I'm not going to make my fortune this way. I already do very well. But I'm really eager to hear what you've come up with. Logan pitched him first. Witch hunt, he said slowly, letting each word settle. It's an RPG. Your avatar is a girl in Salem, 1692. She's just a regular girl, a teenager in a bonnet. Does she have to be a girl? Cronish asked. Couldn't she be a villager?
A villager might also be a girl, Corey pointed out.
True, said Logan. Okay, let me describe how I would generate environments. Cronish held up a hand. You know, he said, let's stop here. It seems a little conventional to me. And in fact, there have already been a few Salem-related games. And as I told you, I'm looking for art as much as anything else. The oral surgeon's gaze shifted to Corey, and he warily asked, Does your idea seem to fit the bill a little more? Corey didn't want to upstage Logan, who had shown him such kindness, even if it was of the pitying variety. Can't you help that nice Corey Pinto? He could imagine Jen asking Logan plaintively in their kitchen over a locavore dinner. Logan and I are in this together, he began. The idea was mine, and I'll write it. But he's the designer and programmer. I know nothing about any of that. Logan said, I can tell you my plans for it. When you listen to what Corey has to say, you might think, whoa, how can that be done, given the number of environments we would need to create? But... Wait, said Cronish. We'll get to that, maybe. To Corey, he said, But first, just tell me how you see it. And so Corey began speaking about his idea, not in the way that he imagined game designers spoke about their own ideas, but just the way he saw it. What if you were on a quest to find the person you love who's died? Corey said to the two men, his voice low. And even though you know that the person you love is dead, and that therefore your quest is pointless, you still have to make the quest, because you can't believe that person no longer exists. I mean, you believe it intellectually, but you don't really believe it in your heart of hearts. Without even knowing it, you search and search, trying to find the person through dreams, through other people, through an endless cycle of yearning, maybe through drugs, maybe through briefly interesting sex with people you would never have thought to have sex with before, through whatever means you can find. But it doesn't work. It never works. How can it? The person you love is dead. Their body has stopped functioning. Their heart has stopped beating. Their brain has no more blood flow. There is no way they can still exist. But in the game version, in our version, which for the moment I'm calling Soul Finder, you might actually stand a chance of finding them. He paused here, but again neither man stopped him or asked questions or nodded or expressed any reaction at all, and it was impossible to tell whether he was bombing or succeeding. Corey just kept talking, because there was nothing else to do. It will be really, really hard, though, he said. I mean, almost no player can ever achieve it. That will be a part of the appeal. Most people who buy the game won't actually ever experience what they're hoping to experience. But every once in a while, a few of them will. People will want to know, how did you do that? How did you find your person? But there isn't going to be an easy answer. It's got to be a very emotionally and intuitively minded game, but counterintuitive as well. The people who are able to find their dead will become famous in the gaming world, because everyone will know that it can somehow be done. It's just that you have to try hard enough and long enough to find the person you lost, and eventually you just might be able to transform that longing into skill. Of course, most of the individual games won't even possess the software capability to locate the dead, but some of them will. and if you get one, it'll be like holding one of Willy Wonka's golden tickets. You won't know it until you test it over months and months of gameplay. But even if you've got one, you still need to do everything right in order to find the dead person.
What made you come up with this?
Asked Cronish, his voice noncommittal. Corey hadn't planned to get into this, but now he said stiffly,
My little brother died. He was run over by a car, and it was the worst thing that ever happened in my family.
One thing I've never forgotten since then, Corey said, speaking quickly and not allowing for the moment in which the other person usually said, I'm sorry for your loss, is that anything can happen at any time. And this isn't a bad philosophy to live by if you're trying to design video games. The whole point of a lot of games, at least the ones that Logan and I have been playing, is surprise, right? The falling boulder, the lightning strike, the ambush. They prepare you for all the real falling boulders and lightning strikes and ambushes that are the decorative flourishes of being alive.
Where were these words coming from?
Right away, he knew. They were coming from Slick, Armitage and Wrist, and his short stint there. But then there had been a bend in the road, a deep, serious turn, and he had finally emerged in a different form. No consultant now, no partner in a microfinance startup ever.
When a person dies, we say that we lost them, said Corey. We lost Albie. It feels that way to me. Like they've got to be somewhere, right? They can't just be nowhere. It doesn't make sense.
Corey reached into his backpack and carefully extracted Albie's notebook, placing it on the table, worrying a little that the surface was damp.
I've made a lot of notes, he said. You could look at this while we're here, but I can't lend it to you or anything because it belonged to my brother.
Cronish began leafing through the pages, as if studying the x-rays of someone's jaw. He was quiet for a long stretch. So much time passed that Logan stood up and went over to the darts corner and began to throw. Corey joined him, whispering,
Personally, I thought Witch Hunt sounded great. I'd play your game. Don't worry about it, man, said Logan, a large man whose entire concentration and energy were now lodged in the pincer formation of his fingers.
At some point, Cronish came over to them, Albie's notebook in hand.
I get it, he said to Corey. My granddad died of a massive stroke when I was 19, and it broke my heart. I would do anything to find him, to show him who I've become.
His eyes looked bright with excitement. They sat back down at their booth and discussed it a little more, getting into further detail. Each player would be able to customize a lost soul. There would be many options for that lost person, not only gender, race, and age, but special add-ons for personality and interests. And there would be a scene, the first time the game was played, in which the player interacts with that beloved person, who at this point in the gameplay has not yet died. So basically the game splits into before and after the death, said Cronish.
Is that what you're saying?
Corey nodded. We don't show the death scene, because that would become the point, and I don't want it to be the point. Plus, it would make the game really conventional. Not to mention gratuitously graphic. The player gets to be immersed in memories, which can be returned to with the scrapbook function at any time. But mostly the game is about the search for the so-called lost soul. The search will take you all over the world, if that's where you choose to look. Or you can just focus on one geographical region that you have a hunch about. Or even, you know, someone's attic.
This is a very weird concept, said Cronish, but also ambitious.
That word, ambitious, hadn't been applied to anything Corey had done in a very long time, but it was a word that he used to hear constantly, applied to him and Greer. They'd also often used it to describe themselves.
The thing is, of course, said Cronish, and now we finally get to you, Logan. Is it actually doable?
Logan put down his beer glass and said, Let me describe it in simple terms. We would bring in an environmental artist, or maybe two. I'm confident that we can make a large number of environments out of a comparatively small number of building blocks. I'm really interested in generating systems that teach the computer to make cool things. I think this could be like that. Corey would write a meta-text, and it could be adapted for different players. It would include some gnomic messages, but they could be read differently depending on who's doing the reading.
It sounds like it would have an immersive theater quality to it, said Cronish, which interests me a lot. In fact, would you consider coming down to New York sometime to go to one of those immersive theater productions? They're doing The Magic Mountain on Roosevelt Island, and I heard the production values are excellent.
Immediately, Corey remembered Greer's recent invitation. You could stay with me, she'd said, and he felt a pulse of pleasure at the idea. But maybe he would feel too sad being at her place in Brooklyn, where he was meant to live and where he'd actually never been over all these years. Even though there was now apparently going to be an angel investor, it didn't mean Corey would have future success, a term that had such different meaning depending on context. Were you a success if someone invested in your video game, or only if lots of people actually played it? And exactly how many people needed to play the game for it to be a success? Were you a success to the people who thought video games were a stupid waste of time, or worse, partly responsible for the death of reading and the collapse of civilization? It didn't really matter to Corey whether he was a success or not. Yet as his life became absorbed with designing the game, there were other changes, too. One night at Logan and Jen's, his co-worker, Hallie Beatty, looked at him and smiled in a new way.
"Want to come over later?" she whispered.
Hallie was uncommonly pale and freckled. There were even freckles on her eyelids, he noticed in bed with her in the farmhouse she rented in Greenfield. There was no hostility here, as there had been between him and Kristen Vells. No sense of time wasting, a ticking clock in the room getting louder. After Albie died, Corey had reverted to a cavalcade of porn, which he hadn't done with such intensity since he was young. Porn, which always had a familiar feel to it, as gratifying and available and gross as a warm bag of lunch from the drive-up window at Wendy's. Jerking off secretly in his room with his mother nearby, as if Corey were a teenager again, he would watch an image on his laptop, all while knowing and actively thinking, "This woman is not into me. This porn star has no interest in me, but probably mild contempt." Not that that stopped him. He'd had few hookups in his life. The first ones, Clove Wilberson, then Kristen, had made him dislike himself. The more recent one, Hallie, had made him feel limber, more awake, reminding him that this collection of parts he carried around still added up to a young man's body. One Thursday morning when Corey was about to head out to clean Professor Elaine Newman's house, his mother met him in the kitchen, fully dressed.
"Can I come?" she asked.
"What do you mean?"
"Can I come to the professor's house? It's been a long time. Maybe I could help."
Corey didn't want to make a show of his surprise. Though she had stopped picking at her arms and saying that she saw Albie, it had been years since his mother had wanted to go anywhere or do anything, and he hadn't expected there would ever be a significant change.
"Sure," he said. "I've got all the supplies over there."
They drove together in silence, and when he let them into the Newman house, his mother stood looking around, surveying the rooms. She ran a finger along the surface of the bench in the front hall, and when it came away clean, she looked at him with approval.
"Nice," she said. "You use Pledge, not the cheap brand?"
He nodded.
"Good. It works better."
After she revisited the rooms that she had cleaned in her previous life, he took the supply bucket from the hall closet and handed his mother a pair of rubber gloves, and they set to work. He had not seen Benedita show an interest or make decisions or be fully distracted from her grief in such a long time. He hadn't seen her do anything physical in so long either. But here she was on her hands and knees in Professor Newman's kitchen, cleaning the tile that she used to clean every week. You could say that cleaning someone else's house was a shit job, that it was disgusting to be entangled in someone else's habits and ways finding nail clippings, finger and toe, and little fluffy hair nests and partly squeezed tubes of cortisone cream or even lube, all of it evidence of a life you really didn't want to think about. But you could also just say that it was work, and that work was admirable, even if it was hard or unappealing or undersung or often maddeningly underpaid if you were female, as Greer used to remind him. His mother wasn't above this work. She may not have liked it once, but she was relieved and revived by it now. Throughout the morning, she showed him tricks, how to use white vinegar in a number of clever ways, how to fold a fitted sheet so it could go neatly on a shelf in a linen closet. They pushed up the windows of the house and let the air circulate. "You are very good at this," she remarked. That was the day that his mother started to become well. He knew it at the time, and he knew it with more confidence later on, looking back. Work was a tonic for everyone, but a special vitamin drink for his mother. At the very least, because she had stopped being able to work after Albie died, work was now a measurement of her recovery. If you could work again, regardless of what kind of work it was, you were getting better. She wanted to come with him the next time, and the next. Working quietly side by side, dusting Elaine Newman's art history books and cleaning her floors with Bona wood cleaner, the artificial smells all over both of them, Corey watched as his mother climbed up out of a well. He didn't want to rush her. He didn't even ask her each week if she wanted to come with him. But soon she was simply waiting when it was time to go there, wearing the clothes she used to wear for cleaning houses, an old shirt and sweatpants and sneakers. Corey came to like those trips with her, the peaceful car ride, and then the hours together in the Victorian house, turning on the high-end stereo and playing whatever was closest at hand. The Newmans favored Sondheim. He thought, when he heard the lines, "Isn't it rich? Are we a pair?" that yes, they were a pair, Corey and Benedita Pinto. The child of immigrants was meant to grow up and surpass his parents, but instead he was level with his mother, truly a pair. She got better and better and became scrupulous about taking her medication. One day, when Corey was sitting in the car waiting for his mother to leave the office of her social worker, she came to the door and waved him in. Corey, surprised, went and sat down in the tiny home office of Lisa Henry, the large and patient person who had been taking care of Benedita over the years.
"Your mom and I thought today would be a good time to discuss something with you," Lisa said. "We've been talking lately about what it might be like if she had more independence."
Corey's mother looked up nervously, nodding, and then she was silent. He realized that it was his turn to speak. "Okay," he said. "That's good. Independence is always good. What kind of independence do you mean?"
"Maybe," said his mother, "I could live with Aunt Maria and Uncle Joe."
"Over in Fall River?"
"They have room now since Sab left."
In a minor miracle, Corey's cousin Sab had straightened himself out through the help of Narcotics Anonymous and had been working as a sous chef at the Embers in Deerfield. Those hands that had expertly cut and chopped heroin and cocaine were now involved with a serious chiffonade of basil and a brunoise dice of carrot and celery and onion. Just the idea that Sab knew words like this, French words, was surprising. Sab had his own set of knives that he brought to work, an excellent Wusthof and a prize Shun, keeping them locked at night in a cabinet at home as if they were guns. A few months earlier, he had married the Embers pastry chef, an older, divorced woman with two daughters. That era of heroin dabbling and various substance selling had ended with the last vestiges of his adolescence. Like the sickliest of first mustaches, it had been deforested, and Sab had started over.
"Your aunt has been talking with your mom about this for a while," said the social worker. She knew that your mom had started helping you clean again for her former employer, and that her thoughts are more organized, and the medication is working, and she's being more responsible for her own self-care. Everything seems to be on an upward swing.
I guess it does, Corey said, lightly stunned. So if this were to happen, he asked, what about the house?
We could sell it, said Benedita. It could command a decent price.
He looked sharply at her.
Who taught you that phrase?
Your mother called Century 21, the social worker explained. Also, Benedita added shyly, on Thursday nights at 10 p.m., I watch, is there a buyer in the house? Things were happening all around him and under him. Sand was churning, moving. Corey remembered the way he had felt when he first snorted heroin with his cousin. The floor had turned soft and dropped, and that was happening again now.
What about me? He thought.
Lisa Henry knew what he was thinking. Corey, she said, did you want to come back and see me another time and talk about logistics? He looked at his mother.
I don't want to intrude here, he said. But she waved this away. So the following week, he returned alone to the office of Lisa Henry, LCSW, where logistics weren't discussed, but his own life was. Lisa Henry's voice was so gentle that her tone itself nearly brought him to tears.
Corey, she said, you want to tell me how you're absorbing the news about your mother's plans? He was immediately and startlingly angry with her for her softness, her kindness, which made him shaky and suddenly emotional. He didn't know if she was a mother, if she had young children, or if as a therapist she'd just gotten used to talking to everyone this way, speaking to the children her clients once were. A giant of a man, 26 years old and sitting in a too small chair, Corey was nearly wrecked by feeling.
I'm okay.
I imagine you're in a kind of overload. You readjusted your whole life after the accident, and now maybe you're thinking you'll have to readjust it all over again. It wasn't even what she was saying that screwed tight his throat, but that she was taking the time and care to say it, her head tilted in concern, calling him Corey like that. He heard her voice from a great distance. Corey, she kept saying. Corey? She was like someone calling his name from three backyards away. He felt suddenly nostalgic about his childhood, which lived like its own distant backyard deep inside him. But then he realized, as the therapist kept speaking to him, that what he missed wasn't childhood or being a child. But being close to a woman, that was what he no longer had. He recalled the first time he had raked his hand through Greer's hair when they were both 17. He had been astonished at its softness. It was like touching some airy, grassy substance. Girls' hair must weigh less than boys' did. There had to be a scientific distinction. Her breasts were supernaturally soft, too. Not to mention her skin and mouth. But her softness wasn't only tangible. There was also the softness of her voice. No matter how loud she spoke, he could speak louder. If they arm wrestled, he would always win, but she wasn't weak. Girls weren't weak. They had a softness sometimes, but not all the time. Whatever they had, it was a compliment to what he had. But it had seemed, when Corey broke up with Greer, that she became like a piece of knotted wire. Where were the qualities he had loved in her? He had taken on some of them himself, because of course everyone was soft and hard, skeleton and skin. But women claimed for themselves the province of softness, which men cast off. Maybe it was easier to say you liked it in a woman, but really, maybe you wished you had it yourself.
Corey pulled tissue after tissue from a box that had been augmented by an overbox made of gold-painted metal. What a sad item this was, designed to disguise tissues, which Lisa Henry's clients needed all the time. Just being in front of her, they were probably